Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, our unfiltered weekly episode. Rabia here, and I'm here with my colleagues, Colin Miller and Michael Thalhan. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello.
Good. How are you guys doing?
I'm nice and warm in my hoodie. So much for the warm weather we had last week.
Well, if Colin could send some our way, that'd be great. I think
I'll send you some warm weather. You send us some rain.
Some rain.
Call it a deal.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a fair
we had
swap.
A lot of rain yesterday. Was it yesterday or the day before? We had a lot of rain sometime not too long ago. But all right. So we're just going to kind of get into it this week. I don't think we have any updates this week. And apologies to our listeners if anybody has sent in any kind of comments and or feedback from last week's episode. I haven't seen any. But I also have been not able to check all our social media platforms. So that's my caveat. But anyhow, let's start off with Mito. Mito, what do you have for us this week?
Okay. I have a story out of Florida, actually, about a surgeon named Dr. Thomas Shiknovsky. He graduated from Midwestern University's Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine in 2009, obtained his first medical license in New York in 2015, Alabama in 2016, was also serving at the U.S. Army Reserve since 2002, and then ultimately started practicing in Florida in 2020. And so that's kind of where he's been of late. Well, he was recently charged with second-degree manslaughter related to a surgery that he conducted in 2024 of a 70-year-old man by the name of William Bryan. Mr. Bryan went in for a scheduled laparoscopic splenectomy, but he ended up unfortunately dying on the operating table because of blood loss, because Dr. Shiknovsky removed his liver instead of his spleen.
Excuse me, what?
Yeah, they're not the same at all.
Listen, I'm just a lawyer. What would I know?
afterward, the staff say that the surgeon insisted repeatedly that the organ that he removed was the spleen and asked the nurse to label it as such.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, you know, the family's obviously also filed a separate civil suit for this malpractice because, come to find out, there's another case. There's another lawsuit against him where he removed a different patient's pancreas instead of adrenal glands. Again, not the same. So within months of him starting to practice in this hospital in Florida in May of 2020, multiple complaints have been filed. And right now he's scheduled to appear in court next month, actually, for a hearing. And the defense strategy suggests that they're going to raise a case of mental health or incompetency to stand trial. My question is, well, then why are you letting him like practice surgery on real patients? Because clearly, if that's what you think, like, you know, what are these people doing? But anyways, I was just thinking about, did you guys ever listen to the Dr. Death podcast?
Yeah, and watch the TV show too. Yeah.
So that reminded me of those cases, right? I never saw the show, but, you know, it's like that was what, 2018? It was before COVID that that podcast came out, and there were multiple series about it, different cases. But, you know, even back then, it was like, well, who's following these doctors that can clearly just jump state to state to state and get new licenses? Like, where's the history, and where are all these lawsuits being hidden that it's not until after a patient either is harmed or ultimately maybe even dies that you find out, oh, there's more,
you know,
to this guy.
What's wild is, like, if you're late to a credit card payment 5 years ago, that shit will follow you for the rest of your life. It'll be part of your credit history. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we have systems in place. If we want to track stuff, we have systems in place that will find you. You know, I can't escape a speeding ticket, you know, three states away. I can't. It's going to find me. This is shocking, but also I have some questions. Mm-hmm. So he removes the guy's liver. Mm-hmm. How long after that does that patient pass away?
On the operating table.
On the operating, right? Because I'm like,
catastrophic blood loss. Right then and there.
Can a person live without a liver? A person can't live without a liver, right? I mean, kidney, I know. One kidney you can lose.
Well, the liver, there's so many connections, right? So you've got to do so much to even remove it if you were actually intending to remove it. Like, so it sounds like he was just kind of doing a chop shop job. And
holy crap.
In his mind, he was like, nope, but that's the right spot. That's the spleen.
What's he charged with?
He is charged with second degree manslaughter.
Second degree manslaughter?
Mm-hmm.
That feels light. What do you think, Colin?
Well, in Florida, that requires criminal negligence. Some states, it requires recklessness. So I feel like under the facts of this case, proving negligence shouldn't be too difficult.
Right.
But do you think the charge is sufficient?
You could charge with depraved heart murder. That would be extremely reckless indifference to the value of human life.
Mm.
And I could see certainly under these circumstances how when you're performing surgery and you remove the liver and it causes almost instant death. I mean, I could certainly see that being a justifiable charge.
Sure.
Look, I've seen livers. We've all seen livers because we've seen animal livers. And I'm assuming human livers kind of have a similar. And when I think of a spleen, I'm like, I feel like they should even look starkly different. Also, was nobody else in that room?
They were. Again, they're saying that like the surgical staff was saying, they were like, that's not it. Like it's over here or no. But they're adamant that he was just like, no, just label it. That was a spleen. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. And, you know, obviously through the investigation, there's testimony from them saying, nope, we called it then and there. But he just, you know, told us like, you don't know what you're talking about. But again, if there are multiple cases and multiple complaints against this doctor specifically, right, as it relates to this.
Is the hospital being sued?
Yeah.
The hospital
is also
being sued. Yeah, of course.
And of course, they're
employing this individual despite the history.
No comments yet from them.
Why didn't he lose his license the first time he did something this horrific?
Exactly. Probably just because he jumped to another state.
Still. Again.
Right.
If I can get a speeding ticket from like three states over, why is that not following him?
Yeah.
Where are the gaps in this system?
I think the gaps are the fact that there are multiple databases. And again, for like who's looking at it ultimately, right? If you're short staffed and you're like, it seems to be okay in this, like I don't know if it varies state to state or if there's like, you know, one that's semi-national. I don't think it's like a CODIS, right? But I think it's the fact that, you know, there's one for licensing, there's one for profiles, there's one for something else. And so I don't know if you just have to look at everything.
Well, that is a problem that is screaming to be solved, somebody out there.
But again, like it's also partially the hospital staff, right? As a patient, when you go to get surgery or any care from a doctor, you're assuming wherever I'm at, this hospital has already done their due diligence. They've already vetted this guy. I don't need to do any background checks.
I mean, even having hospital privileges requires a certain, like not every doctor can get hospital, you can lose hospital privileges
right.
and surgical privileges. I mean, look, we have talked about all kinds of absolutely incompetent, horrific medical examiners on this show.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, folks in the medical profession are always up to par. But that's crazy. And that is so tragic for that man. I mean, going in for what should seemingly be a fairly, not a routine, but, you know, like not such a significant surgery.
Right.
But, oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Well, I had a question that popped in my head. Now I can't remember what it was. So I guess... Well, okay, what is he facing? That's what my question was. What is he facing? Like, do you know if he gets convicted?
No, because also, like, they are kind of considering trying to up the charges. So we'll see what else comes of this investigation.
Mm.
So I don't know yet because it's still under investigation. They're still talking to their witnesses. There's still just a bunch of information gathering from across state lines and stuff since he is, well, not any longer, but since he was licensed in at least three states.
This is actually really scary. As somebody who, you know, I mean, for those of us who will potentially be patients of some surgeon one day or not, that's really scary. And I wonder if there's no system in place. It kind of reminds me of how, you know, in Maryland, I can't remember, I think it's called the Police Bill of Rights, that shields police officers from the public dissemination of their records. Like if they have, you know, like any kind of like they've hurt any civilians and there's been misconduct, you file an official complaint. Well, the public can't access that because of Police Bill of Rights. I know there's some organizations that have been working on like kind of trying to publicly compile that information to a public database. Like if you have an incident with a police officer, law enforcement, like, you know, like report to us. But, you know, it's kind of like, I guess it might even take something like that. I mean, you do have obviously like Google ratings and things like that. But
that's not gonna cut it.
It's not going to cut it. I mean, I have personally had an experience with a doctor who was very kind of well-rated online, just in a regular kind of Google rating. And left me really hurt, actually. So, wow, that's scary. All right. Thoughts, Colin, before I move on?
Yeah, I mean, it's to the point raised earlier, and to what Methil just said, I could easily see this being upgraded to depraved heart murder as opposed to manslaughter, and it's just beyond the pale. The conduct here and the fact that he was still allowed to operate after his sordid history.
What about any criminal liability for the folks who did the hiring?
Yeah, I think that would be tough to get criminal liability. I think that'd be more civil liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be hard to get that far.
And I think that's why they filed the civil lawsuit to hold the hospital accountable as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're going to win that. Yeah. That's going to be settled.
Yeah.
That'll be settled.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
All right, Colin, what do you have for this week?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because mine kind of piggybacks off that in terms of, well, is it just the surgeon who's liable or also the hospital? And this is a case just up the road from me in Charlotte, North Carolina. A verdict was reached on Monday, April 20th. This was a passenger who got a ride in an Uber. They rode in the front seat of the Uber, and at the end of the ride, the driver of the Uber put his hand, grabbed the inner thigh of the passenger, and asked if he could keep her with him. And so she filed a lawsuit against Uber, and just yesterday the jury awarded $5,000 in damages. And that is consistent with an earlier case in Arizona, actually awarding $8.5 million in a case where a person sued Uber because their driver raped them at the end of their drive. But there are other jurisdictions, including Florida, that have specifically exempted Uber from their common carrier statute. And so this is the big question that's teed up. And I think it goes beyond just Uber to the whole gig economy. Things like TaskRabbit, things like Airbnb, etc. And so, right, in North Carolina, this judge finds Uber is a common carrier. They hold themselves out as a transportation company, and they have a sufficient degree of control over their drivers to qualify as a common carrier like Greyhound Bus Line, like a regular taxi service. Then you have other jurisdictions like Florida who say it is not a common carrier. It is not a transportation company. It is a technology company. And so they passed legislation a couple of years ago. I'm going to read from the legislation. They say Transportation Network Company, or TNC, means an entity operating in this state pursuant to this section using a digital network to connect a rider to a TNC driver who provides prearranged rides. A TNC is not deemed to own, control, operate, direct, or manage the TNC vehicles or TNC drivers that connect to its digital network except where agreed to by written contract and is not a taxicab association, right? And so this has ramifications both for Uber, Lyft, which is a huge segment of the economy, but also this whole gig economy. And so I wonder, you know, for both of you, when we're looking at either this specifically or generally, do you see Uber as a technology company or do you see it as a transportation company? And what should that mean for liability?
I see it as a transportation company that uses tech to get their customers.
Hmm?
Right? I mean, like, that's I don't know.
I would agree with that.
Right. That's what makes sense to me. The tech is just, that's like a method to the, this is a means to the whatever end.
Yeah, their purpose is for the ride.
And then based on that, should they be liable for the acts of the Uber drivers? Or
well,
is that not
okay.
enough?
Well, you have to explain more about what is common carrier liability. Because I don't know a whole lot about that. So tell me that, number one. And number two, like, does it involve, like, did they do a sufficient background check? Or, like, you know, or did they, and there's nothing there? And so then that makes sense. Why should they be liable if they had no idea a guy's going to, you know, does he have a pattern of behavior?
Yeah, so common carrier liability would be your company operates the mode of transportation And because you operate and control it, you're responsible for the acts of your drivers, whether it be a car crash or a sexual assault, right? Greyhound hires the bus driver who
even if you've done your due diligence and you've had a sufficient background check and all that.
The jury has to find that you were negligent.
Got it.
Your hiring or supervision, right? Okay. So we still have to find that they're liable. The question is simply, can Uber be held liable like Greyhound if they're not diligent enough in vetting their drivers and supervising them?
So Florida's the only state like this?
I think Utah also just recently said they're not common carriers. So this is a new thing. And so for those of you in a state that wants liability for Uber, you should absolutely speak to representatives, because I think it's Florida and Utah so far have said Uber is not a common carrier.
Okay, so what do you guys think?
I mean, I think that as long as Uber has done the background checks, thorough background checks to, you know, check for criminal history, whatever else, and the driving records, then that's that. Then you just hold the person accountable for what they've done, you know, because.
But you also think it should be considered a common carrier. Uber should be considered. Okay. And you, Colin?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, to your point, Rabia, when I think of Uber, I don't think it's just a tech company. It might be a tech company and a transportation company, but it certainly has an aspect of transportation. And so I think it meets the definition of a common carrier.
I do not. Nobody gets on Uber for the tech. We're trying to get somewhere.
Or right.
The whole point.
Or we're trying to get food with Uber Eats.
Or we're trying to get Uber Eats, right? Like the whole point is to. That's really weird. And I would love to hear. I mean, this is legislation that was passed in these states, right? So that's some lobbying being done by Uber, and they're probably just going to go state to state and see what they can do. I wonder if it came out of some litigation, though. Did it come out of litigation, or do you know?
I'm not sure whether it was or not, yeah.
Florida, you're so special. Never moving there for so many reasons.
Right.
The doctors to the Ubers. All right. Okay. Yeah, I think we're all on the same page there. That's really interesting. All right. And also, what do you think about the damages she got? $5,000 versus $8.5 million. I mean, I get there's a difference in obviously the assault itself.
Yeah. So Uber, in an emailed statement to the press, they took note of the relatively small financial judgment in the North Carolina case and that the jury found it was battery and not a sexual assault. So they tried to spin it to say, oh, look at the minor damages. But I think the broader ruling is, yes, you can be held responsible for the actions of your drivers, which in the future could certainly open themselves up to these much higher financial judgments.
Right, right. And I mean, I don't know the facts of the case, but I do wonder if, I mean, putting his hand on her leg, that was just kind of the start of whatever could have gone down, right? This could have ended up much, much worse. And we don't know how she was able to defend herself or protect herself. But all right. Well, thank you for that, Colin. I have the story I'm going to talk about is a story nobody else wanted to talk about. Thank you, guys. But I decided I had to because I can't imagine. I feel like our listeners are going to be like, what is wrong with you guys? How are you going to like not cover like probably the biggest kind of story in law and crime in the last week? And that is the story of what has been dubbed the Rape Academy. All right. So last week, CNN broke, I think, arguably one of the most enraging and disgusting stories that a lot of us have ever heard. But it was not an unfamiliar story to me because I had been following for, I don't know, like a couple of years, the Dominique Pellicott story, which you guys might be familiar with.
Absolutely.
And actually CNN's coverage opens up with that story, the framing of it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that for folks who haven't heard of it. It all kind of began in September 2020 when this man in France named Dominique Pellicott was caught at like a grocery store or a supermarket using his phone to like try to get images of like up women's skirts. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's caught for that. And the police then seize his electronic devices and they found just decades and decades of horrific, like, you know, videos and photographs of him actually raping his own wife as she is not seemingly not conscious in any of those. Not just her. I'm sorry, not just him doing it, but other men also doing the same thing. So it was something that his wife obviously had no idea was going on for decades. He had been crushing these sedatives into her food and drink, rendering her unconscious for hours, and then recruiting men to come and have their way with his wife without her knowledge, and often taking evidence of it, photographic video evidence of it. In their investigation, the police were able to identify 72 men who had come through that house. They were able to find 50 of them, and they charged those 50 and Pellicott himself. And this woman, Giselle, had no memory of any of it, but obviously when she would come out of these, like, you know, drug-induced whatever, unconsciousness, she was often in pain, bruised, didn't feel well, was like, you know, she was like, something is wrong. And for years, her husband took her to the doctor, and she's like, I'm having blackouts, I'm having memory loss. She thought she was losing her mind. She even got evaluated for early onset Alzheimer's, a brain tumor. And her body was responding in interesting ways. Like, she started losing hair. I mean, like, you know, like, the body is responding to trauma she doesn't even realize she has. So anyhow, he's caught, he's tried, and I think, you know, his wife makes the extraordinary decision, and she's 72 at this time, okay, at the time of the trial, that she's like, I don't want to be anonymous. I want to be public. I want my testimony to be public. I want people to know who I am and what he did. And she created kind of this rallying cry that shame must change sides, that she should not be the one with the shame, but the perp Absolutely. Should be the one with the shame. All of the defendants were found guilty, and the husband got the maximum sentence of 20 years for aggravated rape, which, if he was in America, he would die in prison. He might still die in prison in there, but there's no way he was going to get away with just 20 years. But, you know, our sentencing is much more severe than other countries, for better or worse. Anyhow, so this story, this particular story, obviously has echoes of that. And, you know, at the time, Dominique Pellicott was using this online platform that was a front platform that was shut down. But CNN's investigation uncovered that it wasn't like, just because the platform shut down doesn't mean the people went away. Those people seeking these kinds of opportunities or whatever you want, you know, you like to rape these women, they just moved elsewhere. And so they found, CNN found that there platforms, a platform called Motherless, and these encrypted chat groups on Telegram, of all places. I mean, Telegram is pretty widely used. And there's a chat group called ZZZ, like Z, like people, like you're sleeping, where in 1 year, like 62 million people visited, like, these chat groups and sites. Now, we don't know if it's 62 million in visits. Month, we don't know if there's 62 million people.
Mm-hmm. Unique viewers, yeah.
Oh, you're right. You're right, Meadle. It is what it was in 1 month alone. Holy moly. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I had to make it worse because it wasn't bad enough already.
Yeah. You're right. Right. So this site, these sites basically it is men who are gathering, not just to like share stuff they're doing, but to learn. They're there to like be taught. And, you know, that's where the kind of the name Rape Academy came up, is that they're being taught how to sedate their wives and partners, what kind of drugs to use, where they can access them, what kind of doses to use, how to be careful about it, how to hide their tracks, how to use, you know, like, you know, then, and how to even monetize then, like, you know, the videos and stuff. Like, they're getting paid in Bitcoin by selling these videos online. And they're like a support group for each other. They're like supportive of one another, right? So now as this, you know, on investigation is ongoing, you know, obviously CNN's like, hey, Telegram, what do you think about this? And they're like, oops, we're going to shut down that ZZZ thing, right? I think Motherless also was shut down. I don't know. All that means is people are migrating elsewhere. But the question is, I mean, there's a lot, obviously, look, I don't think there's anything to discuss in terms of the criminality and horrificness and immorality and degraded nature of what is happening here. And I can't even imagine how many thousands of women must be victim to this. And by the way, if you want to read the CNN piece, obviously it's not hard to find, and actual victims have come, you know, they have identified victims who, and they've told their stories and they're on there, and I didn't want to get into all that, but you can read it there. But the question is, how are these platforms getting away with it? How are these platforms getting away with it? Now, apparently, in the U.S., it's very hard to hold these companies liable because of safe harbor laws. And so I was like, "What?" I mean, I kind of have I have some recollection of safe harbor stuff, like from law school, but it's been a long time. So safe harbor is basically kind of like a term for a group of laws that shields online platforms from being held legally responsible, because the law says that they're not the actual publishers of the content. Okay. In the US, the most important, like the kind of like the biggest, most impactful safe harbor law is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which was passed in 1996. So it's been a minute, folks. And its operative provision is the sentence, quote, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service can be treated as a publisher or speaker of any of the information provided by another information content provider." So that means that, like, you know, I have a platform. I'm not, if somebody publishes something on that platform, I'm neither the speaker, I'm neither the publisher. I'm just kind of like a space for them to do whatever. It also has something called this provision has something called a Good Samaritan clause that protects platforms when they do moderate content, meaning they can take down material without being treated as publishers, because you kind of can't have it both ways, right? Like, if I'm moderating content, then maybe I'm a publisher because I have the capacity to edit content and take it down. Anyhow, Section 230 is very, very broad. It protects these platforms from, like, defamation, negligence, invasion of privacy, intentional infliction of emotional distress, a lot of state law tort claims, and most state criminal laws. So that's the U.S. Now, yeah, there are some carve-outs. It's not absolute. And these carve-outs are kind of like where a lot of the litigation happens. It doesn't immunize them against federal criminal law, against federal intellectual property law, against some certain federal sex trafficking laws, and CSAM. So, you know, but these are carve-outs, you understand? Like, it has to, like, specifically fit. And for example, none of the – what's been uncovered in this Rape Academy doesn't actually fall into any of those categories. Now, Europe has a slightly different approach to this. The European Union has something called the e-commerce directive, which was created in 2000. It's got a narrower safe harbor that platforms are immune only until they have actual knowledge that specific content is illegal, at which point they must act expeditiously to remove it. Okay. So when you've got a platform like Telegram, any of these platforms, right, and they're hosting, like, rape video, CSAM, incitement to violence, any of this, the way that the shield behaves is this. Section 230 ends up blocking up most of the civil suits brought by victims. Over and over, courts have thrown out lawsuits against Facebook, Twitter, Grindr, and others over user-generated harm by victims. It doesn't block federal criminal prosecution, but federal prosecutors have to then prioritize the case and prove knowledge, and they just rarely move on this, right? The only big major kind of like move was Backpage. Remember Backpage in 2018? It was completely removed, taken down. And then, you know, there's, if the victims are minors, it's CSAM, so it's a little easier to prosecute that. But, you know, Motherless was like, look, our tagline is we host anything legal, flag it, and we'll look. Like, so other people have to flag stuff, they have to review it. And Telegram operates the same way. And so they are just completely not held liable at all. So right now, the way kind of the battleground is looking is that advocates want to amend Section 230. And, you know, what they're saying, obviously, is that the safe harbor shield goes too far when it's applied to platforms that are not just hosting this content, but actually profiting from the abuse content. And then they want to condition that immunity on meaningful safety practices, making sure that the moderation and the diligence, you know, are meaningful. On the other side, the defenders, which is obviously that much of the tech industry say that, look, if you chip away at Section 230, it's going to lead to over removal of lawful speech, harm smaller platforms that can't afford content moderation at scale, and reduce the platform's willingness to moderate at all, because any moderation might look as look like knowledge that will then strip immunity. So those are kind of like the legal, like, you know, the legal battles that are happening around this issue. Obviously, when perps are identified, you know, we have seen, like in France at least, like, you know, folks being prosecuted. But again, they, you know, they were able to identify 72 men, but only they knew there were 72 men. They could only identify 50. So there are, like, you know, at least 20 others out there who were never actually identified and caught. And that's a drop in. That's one man. That's one man and one woman. That's one case. So we're talking about a global network of predators and rapists who are just operating from jumping from one platform to another with no liability to the platforms. So here's my question to you. I feel like I know where this, how this is, we're going to fall on this, is like, what do you think, Colin, what do you think about like the stance that tech companies have in terms of, like, you know, not amending Section 230 and not broadening or not narrowing the safe harbor?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this kind of brings back into focus everything we discussed earlier, right? Where Uber is doing the exact same thing and trying to essentially get state legislatures to say, we're not common carriers. We don't want to be held liable for the actions of the drivers on our platform. And it's very similar here. It is these tech companies saying, we don't want to be held liable for what is posted on our website, and we don't want Section 230 amended. And it feels like the modern trend is to hold them liable. And I think this recognizes the increasingly interconnected nature of society and how pervasive the internet is in getting eyes on screens. And so I don't think the status quo is going to stay that much longer. I would like to think that in the somewhat near future, we're going to see some amendments. And I feel like we have to clean up a lot of what's on the internet.
I mean, I'm looking at, for example, the carve-outs, the very specific carve-outs to 230, right? Federal criminal law, federal intellectual property law, which, okay, because like that's real serious, Electronic Communications Privacy Act, federal sex trafficking laws, and laws related to CSAM. What about, like, if somebody's posting snuff videos, right? Like, you don't have a carve-out for that? Right. I mean, like, I don't understand. It feels so narrow that it allows for so much other criminal content to be posted. Given this, it just feels like a complete, I feel like it should be the opposite, where like everything criminal is anything illegal, everything criminal and illegal, you know, is illegal. That's it.
That would make more sense.
And anything else is fine. Like, shouldn't it be different?
I mean, let me add something to that, which disturbingly relates to whether this is criminal in some jurisdictions. It might not be criminal in South Carolina.
Oh, God. So tell us why.
We have the crime of spousal sexual battery. And it says if you are married, for that to be a crime, there has to be aggravated force or threats. And it has to be reported within 30 days.
Oh, God.
Which likely excludes a spouse drugging their spouse and having their way with them. A few years ago, I worked with a legislator. We tried to amend this bill to cover this type of drugging case, and it didn't pass. I think there's some effort now to try to amend that. I'm not sure how many states or countries have similar laws, but I mean, there's even a question in some jurisdictions, like
South Carolina.
What's that?
I said South Carolina didn't pass that. Like, what is the public policy reason for, like, keeping that law in the books? That's insane.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know how many other states are like that, but I mean, South Carolina, it's a very disturbing
law. I'm sure there's a number of states that are still like that because that's the problem, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's vestiges. There are vestiges of a different time.
Right. I mean, the defense that was raised in the Pollicott case and other like similar ones is that, well, for the defendants who were invited by the husband to come to the house is like, well, we thought the whole thing was right. like a game, a sex game. Like it was consensual and we did not know that she did not consent to this. Except that you're on platforms where you're teaching each other how to drug women so they don't know what's going on. Come on. I mean, like, I don't know. Well, clearly the defense didn't work. I mean, obviously that defense failed. But I didn't even think about the fact that some of this might not even be a crime.
I mean, that's part of the issue, right? Because state by state, you have nothing but loopholes depending on what their laws say. So, yeah, they should definitely make amendments. But I feel like that'll take forever because, again, people are always going to find a loophole. And if you shut down Motherless or shut down any other site, someone's just going to come up with another way.
Yeah. And look, these are not going to be like easy, clean prosecutions, right? I mean, like the amount of manpower it's going to take and resources it's going to take to identify perps who could be all over the world to exert, how do you exert like jurisdiction over a lot of these, you know? So then it's like, you got to take your case and go to another country and say, hey, you might want to find this guy who like lives in your whatever, you know, a jurisdiction. I just think that also is going to prevent these things from being pursued. It's just the manpower is going to be overwhelming. Which then really, the easiest way to tackle it is by making the tech companies liable, right? Like, that seems like the easiest way to, like, you get to the root of it. Just make sure the tech companies know you're going to pay a really steep price if you're allowing this to happen. Because it might otherwise be impossible to catch 60 million men around the world doing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
It's so sickening. Like, we need a Teach Men Academy. Teach boys so that they're good men academy.
Yeah, that's that. All right, guys. Well, Meetal, I'll turn it over to you. Why don't you give us an update?
I was about to do that. Yeah, for sure. For those of you that are sending in questions and stuff, we're going to be scheduling a bonus for anyone on Patreon. That'll be coming up soon. If you're not on Patreon, get on Patreon. But you can obviously, you know, we've got our Toward Justice community on Facebook, the Facebook group, Instagram. We're still on X. If you want to join Patreon, go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. You could send us emails through our website, which is also undisclosedpod.com. SpeakPipe. There's all the different ways, guys. All the different ways. But, you know, we'll also post soon about when that's going to be scheduled for those of you who want to join us live as an audience member. But, you know, any questions that you have, which last month we got a whole bunch. So thanks for sending those in. Keep sending them in. And, yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for the stories. And thank you guys for listening. And if you have any ideas for us, always pop them in Facebook, DM us, let us know. And we will be back in a week.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.